They abandoned their belief in the supernatural. Now you are asking me to sabotage that achievement, to send them back into the dark ages of superstition and ignorance and fear? No!
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Trolling with Logic. It's the 17th of May, and it's 7 p.m. here in the UK and 2 p.m. over in the States. Just to go through all the usual announcements, you can call into the show at any time. The Skype contact details are on your screen. So just add us to Skype, send us a quick PM with a your question, and we'll add you in due course. Just to remind you, the show, everything's recorded, later uploaded to iTunes and YouTube. So by calling in, you grant us permission to use your likeness. And also, the show's published under a public domain license, as you can see up in the corner. So feel free to copy and distribute the show any way you like, as long as you link back to us. And I'll just go through the panel for tonight. And welcoming back, as always, Marty. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
And welcoming back after a week's break, Sheila. How's you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks.
Okay, and I think Empty Without Brain is meant to be here, but he's watching the FA Cup final right now, so he'll be done when that's done. So he's got priorities at the moment. Anyway, let's carry on with the introductions. And we've got two guests tonight, and they are both the chair and vice chair of the Scottish Secular Society, an organisation myself and Sheila are got quite close links to. So welcoming the newly elected chair, Spencer Fields, welcome.
Evening.
And am I pronouncing your surname right?
No.
No, all right.
No one ever does.
All right.
Files,
all right. And
just pretend that he's not there.
And the newly elected vice chair, okay, I'm going to try this, Ramin Forghani. I should have asked you before about this.
That's true.
Okay, big welcome to the show, guys. I'll just ask you the introductory question. We'll start with Ramin. How did you get involved with the Scottish Secular Society, and how did you end up becoming the vice chair?
Well, long story, entering to this stream, you know, secularism and being an activist in general. I came to UK about less than 2 years ago. I came here as a student in Glasgow, started doing masters in environmental engineering. Later on, I started a group called the Iranian Atheist Association. Afterwards, I started Ex-Muslim Scotland, which is the Scottish branch of the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain. I got familiarized with the Scottish Secular Society through a course mate of mine in university. She was involved with the group. So she suggested me the group. She said, you may be interested. I had started joining the meetings of the group in our favorite pub. And later on, the kind people in the group, they nominated me for the vice chair, and I was lucky to get elected as that position.
Yeah, so it's been quite a quick rise to the...
Yes, I should say.
Okay, and Spencer, can you tell us about how you got involved and, you know, how you eventually ended up becoming the chair?
Yeah, I've always paid a lot of attention to religion from purely evolved from issues I have with a youngster, school, with certain institutions. And so throughout my teens and my very angry 20s and early 30s, I was always keen on reading what the secular situation was like. But really from a UK perspective, I was blissfully unaware that there was a lot of activity taking place in Scotland. And it wasn't until I attended one of the demonstrations outside Scottish Parliament just before we passed same-sex marriage bills. I met Robert Canning and Gary Ottam and a few others who were the face of Secular Scotland. I had joined the Facebook and posted one or two things. And just engaged in discussion, general secular discussion with those guys. I attended a few of the evening meetings like with Ramin, you know, a few beers with the rest of the gang, and had real interest and affinity with all the things that they were seeing and how they were feeling about religious issues across Scotland. And it became quite apparent also with Caroline's situation that she would no longer be chair and that they would be coming. So they very kindly actually asked me if I would be interested in sort of becoming the more or less the face of secularism for Scotland, which at the time I wasn't quite sure I was ready for, because I'm a big believer in learning, and but they were convinced. They said, Spencer, you know, we'll back you all the way, we'll support you all the way, and here I find myself as chair of the Scottish Secular Society, and for the last 6 or 7 weeks, as long as I've been in the room, we seem to have hit the ground running.
Yeah.
There's been so many things happening in the last 2 months. It's just been incredible. Incredible.
Yes, here we are. So I'm going to ask this, like, from a devil's advocate position, like, you know, a lot of people will think, you know, Scotland's a secular country anyway, so why do we need the Scottish Secular Society?
Yeah. Do you want me to take this, Raman?
Yes, sure. We should say that this country is mother of secularism, isn't it? But unfortunately, we see stuff going on around that are disappointing. And for sure, there is a need for organizations like this to defend this achievement that many big people have done during history. So definitely, there is a need for that. At the moment, the SSS is going through a petition for education in the Scottish Parliament, which is willing to push opt-in instead of opt-out for the religious observance in schools. And many other things are going on. There is some concerning matters going on in England. For sure, it's not a matter for Scotland, but it can spread to Scotland as an infection, like the Trojan case in schools going on in Birmingham. So, yes, I believe there is a need for a strong Scottish Secular Society.
But for us, at the moment, looking at it from a national perspective, there is secularism is a need. Religious interference in Scotland is still ever-present, if not as strong as it's ever been in Scotland. So, the way it's entwined with our education system, and you know, you can read on our Facebook page and our website the issues we face there, how it's still entangled, still very much enshrined, it's still seeking constitutional recognition, it still affects from a micro level, it affects me directly. I've had the same issues as Mark Gordon, our petitioners had. I'm still living those issues at the moment with trying to make sure that my child doesn't have to participate in religious observance in his primary school. He enrolls in primary one and I get the in August, and I'm currently seeing the front end of the resistance to change that we have and the inertia within the education system with religion, the influence that our unelected representatives of Scottish education systems exert. And that has never been more evident to us than through what Raman alludes to there regarding our petition to the government to change to opt-in rather than opt-out, because it's well documented how problematic opt-out is, how hidden, how difficult accessing information is, whereas if a parent was asked at the start of primary one or at the end of nursery, do your child want to participate in this? Do you allow your child? It would be a game changer. But unfortunately, it's unfortunate, but there's also many positives from it.
Yeah.
The petition was referred to the Education and Culture Committee, which was read last week, and Mary Scanlon, who is a Conservative MSP and is herself also a Christian, was pretty much the only person in the room that was vocal about what the next step should be on our petition. And she moved to back what the government status was that there was nothing wrong with the current situation. We believe clearly is something wrong with it. I mean, I've seen it this week. I've had the head teacher of my school refusing to take my calls, refusing to offer me a meeting. I've had my other child has issues. My stepsister's children have issues at her primary school, where they're forced to undertake learnings on creationism immediately after teachings of evolution. They have to shout back to the school teacher. The school teacher shouts to them, who made us? They all shout back to the class of 36, God made us. And this is happening in a primary school 2 miles from my front door. So on a micro level, we have those kind of day-to-day issues that secularism really has to be proactive and confront. Institutionally and constitutionally, we have to maneuver at the political level and make sure that we make as much noise as we can so we can at least challenge the positions of privilege that the Church of Scotland and Roman Catholic Church seem to be so reluctant to let go of in Scotland.
All right, I'll hand over to Sheila now.
Thanks, Cal. I know we're going to kind of get into this a little bit later, but do you think, like, the upcoming referendum, should it go toward Scotland gaining her independence? Do you think it would make it easier for the Scottish Secular Society to get things accomplished than an easier time than you're having now? Or like the petition, for example?
That's a really good question, and probably the most topical question, Sheila, that the Scottish Secular Society has ever had to face. It's courted much controversy and attention to the Scottish Secular Society, which has, for us, been fantastic and most welcome. One of the things I was really keen to understand was what would be the secular position in an independent Scotland when I inherited this tenure from Carolyn Lynch, and to see how the group felt about publicly advocating and backing an independent Scotland, and what would that mean for us as a secular entity within the UK and within an independent Scotland. And first of all, we have to consult our members. We had several polls asking our Facebook members how they feel about independence. Should we, as a group, back in? First of all, do you support independence was the first poll. 90% of respondents said yes. And then we put the question out, should the Scottish Secular Society go public with supporting Scottish independence? And it was the same outcome. So it was inevitable that we wanted to take that line. And from a personal perspective, it's such an enormous question. It is the biggest question. Anyone who is eligible to vote in Scotland on that question will never participate in anything quite like it ever again. And I think from an individual to associations to organisations to public companies to education systems, everyone should publicly be allowed and express their point of view on this. It's monumental. It's got repercussions that will last centuries. So as a group of secularism, we found if Scotland decouples itself from England, because it's not, or from London, it's not really a question about breaking away from everyone else. It's really a question about breaking away from the centralised capitalist, mutational capitalism that is Westminster, and seeing, well, what is left after that? What does religion look like? What does the landscape look like in an independent Scotland? And it makes things easier for us. It makes it easier to challenge the religion in Scotland, because one, the obvious question, the obvious thing for us is we instantly get rid of 26 unelected bishops from the House of Lords who have a direct and proactive say on legislation and policy in the United Kingdom that affects everyone in Scotland. So instantly that diminishes along with all the hereditary peerages who are also unelected. So that sets us off on a good footing. We also anticipate that the rewriting of the Constitution is something else we can now start to lobby, and we can try our hardest. And we're working with members within the society on a consultative level with Dr. Elliot Wilmer, who's been absolutely fantastic in consulting with us on all aspects of the Constitution and where religion would sit. And he actually put out our position statement on the website, why the Scottish Secular Society have come out in favour of independence. And it's something that we now are already seeing. The mainstream media have instantly reacted to this. We've had the Daily Mail, we've had the Telegraph, we've had MSPs writing blogs about our decision to go independent. We've had no members have any real issues with it. I think we've two people who have dissented from we've had to offer. However, we've seen an in our membership. In fact, many of the SLPs are absolutely amazed that our Secular Society would back the campaign so publicly. And they understand the reasons for it as well. It takes away the mist, but it gets rid of everything that goes on with the Church of England. Our media will only have to focus on religious context that is within a Scottish context, which again simplifies the whole process. But we don't know if we're going to get independence. That's the thing. It is a huge gamble. We think we've nothing to lose either way, no matter what happens. So backing independence for us, I mean, it certainly it brings in the parameter. You know, it makes our targets and our objectives a lot easier to identify, and it makes our actions and our strategies easier to implement, or it should. That's what we're hoping.
Well, I do not have a position in the independence debate, I should say. The reason that I joined the Scottish Secular Society was the background that I had. I'm coming from Iran, and it's a country that desperately needs the concept of secularism. You know, it's a theocratic system. So religion is everywhere. It is in anything that you can imagine in everyday life. So the reason that I joined the group was that matter, and I'm gonna fight for my beliefs as much as I am able to. So regarding the referendum debate, I do not have a position on that.
I'm uncomfortable, and religious bodies should actually take a similar position. An enormous amount of Euroscepticism across the land, across England, because I don't believe that we are running anything remotely parallel to England as far as our perspectives on Europe are concerned. But, you know, for a government to be talking of leaving or repealing the Human Rights Act and leaving the United Nations, I mean, two areas that are their biggest strengths, that are upholding the very thing that protects them from that is really purely secularist. It's almost banal that they would not encourage the Scottish Secular Society, who, I hasten to add, are not just there to stop religious interference regarding state affairs, we're there to protect them from state interference as well. And that's often lost and often forgot, because they like to try and define the Scottish Secular Society and define our constitution, define what we stand for and who we are. But independence for Scotland, for me and for them, and for the religious institutions of Scotland, it's a no-brainer. It's something we should all support, and we really all need to be behind and hope that it's a yes vote come September.
Recently, in the group on Facebook, there was posted, like, the Constitution of Scotland. As I understand it, that's the proposed new, that's what you guys are hoping will be the new constitution if independence is gained, is that correct?
It's a proposal, nothing more.
Right.
There's a really good book out. There's a really good book published by, it's actually written by Elliot Gilmer, and it's a model constitution for Scotland and what Scotland would really look like as an independent state. And I think what is going to happen is there will be an enormous consultative process behind the constitution for Scotland, and there's many people, Mark McNaught as well as one of them, who are currently putting together the groundwork for the constitution. I've had a slight insight as to what the religious aspects look like as a proposal, but you know everything else that the potential Scottish constitution will be modelled on will, I think, primarily be starting afresh. So we really are feeling our way around a little bit in the dark. But I only really at this moment pay attention to the religious elements of a Scottish constitution and what they are seeking to ascertain by having inclusion and recognition as a national religious body for Scotland, or not, hopefully.
I want to bring Marty into this because...
Because
you're coming from Sweden, which has had you've already had the experience of going independent and trying for a secular state and that, so...
That was very long ago. So.
Well, but it's sort of a similar, because it's a similar size countries involved.
Yeah, maybe. But I'm just not clear about why Scotland is looking for independence now. I mean, I know that there's been a history where back in like the 1300s or something, Scotland gained independence and then lost it later on. And it's been this back and forth sort of thing. But what's happened now that has sort of raised this issue again?
It's not been one thing, Marty. It's been a whole number of things over a long period of time. Scotland traditionally tends to lean left. You know, we are more radical in our politics. There's a saying in Scotland that we have more pandas in Scotland than conservative members of Parliament.
Okay.
So, you know, and that it's all about a democratic process and a representative process. We don't have that in Scotland at the moment. And we believe we are not a region of England. We are not a region of the UK. Scots are ferociously proud people. I mean, I'm actually English. I'll squint that one just now, but I'm a naturalised Scot. So if you look at the voting patterns within Scotland, we don't vote Conservative. We don't want Conservative rule, yet we are ruled by a Conservative government.
Yeah.
You know, it's predominantly SNP and Labour across the political landscape of Scotland. So you can say that we are fairly slightly left to full left. And what we're looking for is a fairer and more equal society. And the politics that are coming out of Westminster, such as the bedroom tax and the way that they absolutely demonise the poor and the disabled. And, you know, my personal point of view, my mother-in-law was asked to attend a meeting where she had to demonstrate how disabled she was. Three-year-old woman, she's dragged up in front of three people in suits and basically told to explain to them why she's disabled, and she had to provide her medical background, her medical evidence, consultation letters from her consultant, and sit there like a dragon's den approach and beg for assistance and prove that she's ill, that she's incapable to work. She has multiple physical issues. There is no way she could hold down a job. Not even physically, but mentally, she just couldn't. And I found the fact that many Scots like myself find that the fact that we are allowing this to even happen is disgusting. It's deplorable. And we don't recognise that. We don't recognise our government. We're so out of tune with the way that we think in Scotland. It's untrue. And then there's everything else that they're lumbering up, such as the bedroom tax, where they're threatening evictions. They're putting thousands of children, up to 20,000 children in poverty because they're putting extra financial burdens on their parents, and without any thought of the consequences.
I had no idea it was that bad.
Oh, it is. It is that bad. And it's a place that now, that Scots people are now waking up and thinking, oh, we want autonomy away from this mindset, away from the Euroscepticism, away from the demonising the disabled and the poor, away from the spin and the hatred that is placed on immigrants nowadays in this country. It's just despicable. And the treatment of other faiths as well, the way that Islam is portrayed in the Daily Mail and the Sun and some of the other tabloids, it's sickening. And there's some really fantastic stuff coming out now from Wings Over Scotland, from some of the real high-profile indie guys on Twitter. And they're now showing on a daily basis the English version of a tabloid newspaper and the Scottish version. So it's strung up there for all to see the insane differences and manipulation of the media. You know, even our mainstream broadcaster, the BBC, a national broadcaster, the BBC, has been so biased, London-centric on this. It just, you've got to live it and see it to experience it. It's not even insidious, it's not sneaky, it is black and white. It's there for all to see, to the point that there's now a petition for to put to our government to recognise the BBC as a group who is in the no camp for independence, because they have done so much work on behalf of the Tories, on behalf of the English government, to try and sway the vote of the Scottish nation or the undecided. It's actually working against them. It's making more people want to vote yes, because this publicly funded body is supposed to be impartial, is not being impartial by any means. So, sorry, I'm also acutely aware we're now talking about independence.
I think it's inevitable. I found even just doing this show that it's come up when they hear my accent. I've had people in the chat room fire the question to me all the time. So I think
one other thing, Marty, the SNP and other groups are currently, what's in the press at the moment is that there's been another poll. I can't remember if it was Maury YouGov or the Tory government that did it themselves, that they've spent £46,000 of public money on, and they've hidden the poll. They're not showing anyone it. You know, the yes vote was about 22 to 24 percentage points behind winning the yes vote. And the margins have now gone as tight in some polls as 4 or 2 or even neck and neck. But our own government has now hidden a poll, a public poll, I hasten to say, that should be public, from the eyes of the Scottish people, because it suggests that the yes camp has now either caught up or possibly even taken over the no vote. And that's what we're experiencing at the moment. It's becoming a little bit dirty. It's becoming a little bit sneaky. And I'll have to say, none of this is coming from any of the yes campaign. None of it. It's all coming from no. All the negatives. You know, there's nothing positive about the no campaign. Sorry, I feel like I should be on a soapbox.
That's all right.
That's okay.
But it makes me really angry, because it's not democratic, it's not fair, it's not representative by any means, it's horrendously manipulative.
Marty, I just wanted to ask you, we have spoken this before, now sadly it's slipped my mind, but what's the state of the church in Sweden? Is it part of the actual state and government?
No, not anymore.
Okay.
It's pretty recent. I think it was like in 2000 that we separated church and state officially.
And was there a big fight put up by the church?
No.
All right, because it's...
The church has really nothing to say anyway, so...
Yeah, because it's very much the opposite. The church is really digging its heels in now. I think you can give us some examples of that, but I know the examples myself.
Really, where do we start? Yesterday there was... From a secular perspective, we are trying to engage with the church at the moment. My predecessor, Caroline, and indeed Gary, and amongst others, have been writing and emailing members of the Kirk and members of the Catholic Church to engage in some dialogue. In fact, Elliot put a plea out recently to Neil MacLeod, who's a solicitor church elder, I believe, who's currently working for the Yes campaign on behalf of the Kirk, and is taking a case at the National Assembly, I think, yesterday. I followed up on an email that Elliot had asked him to stop, let's disarm each other and let's sit down, and if we're going to go positively forward in a new Scotland, we need to be at a table, reaching some kind of consensus as to where religion sits in Scottish society and the secular voice looks like. We are being marginalised to a large extent. We're not just being marginalised by religious groups. We find that some of our, we even find MSPs are trying to marginalise us at the moment. One blog that's gone out from Murdo Fraser recently, I think maybe yesterday, and for me, just perfectly illustrates the position that we're up against with the church, digging its heels in and clawing onto its privileges. It berates us as being a small and tiny voice that doesn't really represent anyone in Scotland other than ourselves. However, we believe differently. We know that we don't officially represent anyone but secularists, perhaps some atheists and some sceptics, but we do believe that we speak on behalf of fairness and equality for Scottish people. And that's something that seems to be areas that the church just doesn't want to discuss, but just they seem to have forgotten the whole ethos of the church. And this MSP chap, has written a fairly damning blog on what secularism looks like, because we are a small voice, but we've got a lot of muscle. We have a large clout, and the reason that we have such a large clout, and the reason the media asks us for quotes, and that the radio broadcaster asks us to appear, to come on radio so people can listen to us on television so they can watch us, is because what we've got to say is important, and it's reflective of the bigger majority in Scotland. And the church is they're just not willing to even acknowledge that this is happening. I was at a Scottish identity conference at the Mound last week, listening to Will Stoddard give a talk about Scotland and what does secularism look like and where should it be positioned in a modern Scotland in relation to Scottish identity. And he put the case as eloquently anyone than I've ever heard. He basically says that it needs to decouple itself from Scottish society, that it needs to stop trying to cling on to its positions of privilege on education committees by having three non-elected representatives. It also needs to back off from believing itself to be the nation's conscience. Whenever any incident or anything of a national tragedy happens, in Scotland. If you think, consider this for a minute. The Kirk only has 8% of Scots are in the Kirk, are members of the Kirk. 92% of Scots do not belong to the Kirk. However, the Kirk has on 70% of non-denominational schools non-elected representatives, and they're a small group. We're a small group. The humanists are a small group. They don't enjoy such privileges. We don't have a hotline to our MSPs. You go on the Muslim Council of Scotland website, you can go on to the Kirk's website or any religious body's website. You will see photographs, correspondences, and emails or civic duties, any kind of duty being performed along with our senior members of Parliament in Scotland. We don't have that. And they're scared at the moment because the historical privilege in place that they've been afforded is diminishing. Their numbers are dwindling. We have some of our secular members intentionally go around some of the churches across Glasgow and Edinburgh on Sundays just to look at the demographic of the congregations, because we know the church won't report that accurately. And it's full of aged people. It really is. It's full of elderly who, in the next 10 to 15 years, will disappear from the church. The church have dozens and dozens of old abandoned buildings up for sale because they just can't fill them in Scotland. However, they still are afforded this disproportionate voice in Scottish society. And I think it's quite hypocritical of someone like Mr. Fraser to point out that we are a small society punching above our weight, when indeed we are actually a small society that is growing exponentially, week by week, month by month, and we have competitive interests with an organisation that is in a slow but terminal decline in Scotland. And it's not right. It's not right that they should have this access and this influence to our politicians. It's not right that they should sit on school boards. It's not right that they have their funding paid across the chaplaincy costs, across their expenses paid, £600,000 in the last 3 years, expenses paid just for petrol money for going to hospitals to perform sanctimony. The last rites on Roman Catholic patients. It's not right that there's nearly £4 million of the Scottish health budget spent on chaplaincy care in Scotland. There's just so many things that's not right with the church in Scotland at the moment. And the only ones who seem to be banging the desk hard and shouting the loudest about this is the bunch of wee secularists that Mr. Fraser thinks we are. But yeah, hopefully this will all change. It is going to change.
Okay, I think we can bring in our caller. Who are you? We've never seen you before. Welcome, Gary. Some strange man called Gary's appeared.
Hi, Cal. How are you doing?
I'm all right.
How are you, Gary?
Nice to see everybody. Hello, yeah. Sheila.
Hey, Gary. Always a pleasure.
How you doing? It was nice to see you. Well done, Spencer. It's really nice to see him on form today. And hi, Ramin, as well. Hey. I mean, wow. The Scottish Secular Society is absolutely going down a storm in Scotland. It's unbelievable. In the last 2 days, we've had blogs from people absolutely outraged by us, detests us. And that's wonderful publicity. Yeah. One was by a Tory MSP in the Holyrood government, Murdo Fraser, who was demanding to know, what is our membership? Who are they? Who are these people? And really, really annoyed and angry because we were actually, you know, demanding that we should, you know, them. We must undermine them and get rid of them. I think, well, what kind of democracy is he promoting? He's in Parliament. Extraordinary. And then we also had the day before that, we had an extremist religious, we have what we call, up in Scotland, we have what we call the Wee Frees. And they're the Free Presbyterian Church. And they're an extremist church. I mean, they're known for tying up the playground swings on a Sunday. Yeah. They used to do that. They don't do that anymore. They're dying out. I mean, anyone that extreme that, you know, protests at ferry arrivals to the islands, because they're mostly on the Western Islands. If you look at a map of Scotland, you'll see them right up there in the top north. But they claim they're making ground because people do need a more extreme religion now. And that is what is happening right now. We are getting an extreme religion as the old ladies that would screw the caps on jars of chutney and the lovely old preachers that would preach about the starving in Africa. That lovely old church is dying, and in its place is a nasty extremism that is demanding privileges and a right to be heard in the new constitution and in the parliament in Westminster too, and have got those privileges.
Gary, just to interrupt you, can we welcome back after a very long break? Empty, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay, boys. How are things?
That's all right. So,
please, I'm fine over here.
Yeah, like you say, he's been off for about a year now. This is one of our old co-hosts, so please lock up your sheep now. He's back. So I thought I have to get that in there.
Sorry to interrupt, Paz. Just been watching the FA Cup final now.
For, oh,
3-2 to Arsenal. They were 2-0 down as well.
Yeah, I picked up the final when they were 2-0 down for Arsenal to win. So.
Oh, no, I couldn't believe it, Jesus. How the hell they managed that, I don't know.
Okay, well, where were we? I've forgotten.
Yeah, well, the Scottish Cup final was today too.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
It's like St.
Johnston. Yeah, St. Johnston won that one. Anyway, shall we go back on topic?
Sorry, guys. What are we talking about? It's the entire thing.
Yeah. I think, Gary, you were in the middle of something there.
No, I'd finished, so that's fine for me.
Okay. There was one question I wanted to get to Ramin, and that's the whole issue of Sharia law in the UK.
Yeah.
Now, I've asked so many different people and they all give me a different explanation of what they mean by, you know, the push for having Sharia courts. So from your understanding, what is actually going on there?
Well, I don't know if you heard about it or not. I went down for a demo in England, in London, 2 or 3 weeks ago. So basically the Law Society has legalized Sharia law in England, if you like. And they say we have written guidance for it. Basically meaning that they recognize it to be to take part in England. It's very concerning. It's so scary. I just hope that it doesn't make its way to Scotland. That's all I can hope. And we try to push the Law Society to stop this guidance. Well, there is a little hope because they actually have set up a seminar for this matter going on, and the tickets for that event has sold out. But yes, the activists, the right groups are trying to push Law Society to stop this matter because it is it's scary. You know, 2-3 days ago that a woman in Sudan got sentenced to death because she actually had converted to Christianity. So that's basically what Sharia law is, and we are legalizing it here.
Is it actually that basically people are going to get stoned to death for anything in Great Britain?
Well, no. No. Well, a part of Sharia has got recognized, and the guidance for it has been written, which is for the will of the people. So, but when you recognize a part of a law, doesn't it mean that you actually are recognizing whole thing? Because it's a consistent system. You are taking a part of it to the legal system, and who knows what's gonna be the next step?
It's a crack in the wall. That's the problem, Mark. It validates one element of Sharia, and I think that's where the problem is. I actually have some secular legal friends, 4 or 5 of them, who are, you know, they're behind the scenes of corresponding with relevant people in Scotland to try and formulate some position statement on Sharia as far as Scotland's concerned. But in England, obviously, it's a different setup. And I think this is what the issue is, you know, we have one rule of law that is absolute for all in the land. And we can't have a dual or parallel system within any element of our lawmaking. We just can't. And this is the first time that in British Isles that Sharia, we believe it goes on. We know within some of within the Asian community, within the Muslim community, or other communities that want to adopt it goes on. Some of the principles of Sharia, they take place. It's very difficult. A very difficult thing to identify. It's a very difficult thing to find. Because it's a closed community, where Sharia is concerned. But this is the first time that it's been positioned in the public arena. And to say it hasn't gone down well would be an understatement. It's a dangerous ground, very dangerous ground when you validate something like, one legal component, which is effectively all about what do they do with their will. What happens when someone dies? You know, and the discrimination, and under Scottish law, it's discriminatory. Especially under Scottish law, especially it's discriminatory as to where the the last will and testament of three, where the father's money is appointed to which member of the family. And Shariah tries to circumnavigate that. Okay. And if you run two parallel systems, then the consequences can be fairly severe in the long term.
Well, yeah, I can understand that if you have this sort of a parallel system that runs in the shadows, if you will, like it's not officially supported, then at least you can say that what they're doing is illegal. But if any part of it becomes legal, then yeah, I can see the problem there.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been enshrined. It's not been positioned as law here. It's advice. It's an advisory statement from the Law Society as to how to deal with components of Sharia when dealing with wills from members of Islam. And that's the problem. It's like, well, we have one part of that we want to bend this part of the law to suit our religious beliefs. So then does the religious belief then supersede law in the country? No, it doesn't, and it shouldn't. And everyone who's been involved in protests, such as Ramin Down, I mean, to get on the train and go down to London, a chap who's here in asylum from Iran, I mean, that tells you just what Ramin's lived it, and he knows the consequences of this. And he's in a foreign country at the moment, Ramin, and he wants to make it his homeland, and if he believes strong enough to get on the train, go down there, wave a placard, and tell the people of this country this is wrong, you know, then there's something. You have to pay attention.
And now if the Sharia law thing is allowed to pass, don't you run the risk of, like, what just happened in Sudan with the pregnant woman who's now sitting on essentially death row for being Christian? The instance of that would probably increase, correct?
A long way down the road, yeah. You're right. I mean, that's highly unlikely and not probable in at the moment, anyway, in the UK. But
right.
This is the issue, isn't it? I mean, that is the most extreme, abhorrent and disgusting version of interpretation of that law. However, Sharia law is Sharia law. And we don't want to get into a dialogue about what is good about it, what is bad about it, what is ugly about it. We want to treat it holistically. We want to say the whole thing is incompatible, full stop, with British law. And this is where the fear is. It's something that you point out is, yeah, we see that. It's been a million miles away from where we are just now. However, if you put the keys in the ignition and start driving towards it, you're on the road. We don't want the keys in the ignition.
That's the thing, because in the end, that's the reason why some people from that part of the world actually come to the United Kingdom, because they want to escape from the punishments that Sharia law for. The thought of it coming to the United Kingdom, shit, they're off under court leave again, isn't it?
Yeah, and Ram will provide testimony to that. You know, exactly. He comes to the UK to escape the Sharia law and then to find himself possibly confronted with it again, even though it's in its fairly embryonic stages, is something he finds fairly astounding. Is that right, Ramin?
Yes. Well, I said it in my speech in front of the Law Society. I said, I know that legal system in England and Wales is separate from Scotland, but I really couldn't stay in Glasgow while these people were shouting the truth. I went there to say, well, I have stayed here. I don't have gone home. I'm away from my family because I just can't handle it anymore. I just can't handle that legal system, that law, the Sharia law. Now you're bloody legalizing it here. That's not acceptable at all. It's not logic. It's nonsense. It's simply nonsense.
We don't just need you to challenge it in Iran, Ramin. We also need you to challenge it here in the UK, where there's evidence of parties where there is female genital mutilation, where they're holding parties to do this crime to young female children. And there has been one prosecution. I might be wrong if there's more.
No.
Whatever it is, it's not enough.
No, it's not.
You're absolutely right, Gary. I mean, there's 3,000 children in Scotland at risk from female genital mutilation. And one positive thing, actually, that Mike Russell's done is there's a letter going out from our government to every school in Scotland to make them aware of children that may well be at the risk. And this is times such as when they come back from summer holiday. to instructing physicians and GPs to be alert to any of the consequences regarding complications and abdominal pain and passing of urine, infection, etc. So, you know, we are trying to be as proactive in intervention. However, you know, Gary's absolutely right. The lack of proactivity in actually pursuing prosecution is absolutely disgraceful. And considering that this potentially affects 50,000 children across the UK every year, and for there to be one, possibly two now, prosecutions on this, it's an inertia from our government, because they're absolutely terrified to have that kind of, or that level of confrontation with religious bodies. And they would have to be confrontational, they would have to be adversarial. The very violent act of genital mutilation is abhorrent, and it's extreme in every case. But this inert attitude towards it that we have in the country, I'm left scratching my head. I really am. I just don't understand why we entertain the concepts of it. It's awful. And we let ourselves down. We really do. We fail the children. We fail others. We fail people who have compassion. We fail the children, full stop, and it's awful.
But fair enough if they want to do that themselves, but in the end, if you're forcing children to go through that kind of process, it's just ridiculous. Like you mentioned, it's just we're failing the children if we're not able to combat that and say, you can't do that, that's ridiculous. And in my opinion, people who do that to children should be put into a mental institution, because it's just ridiculous.
It shouldn't happen in any part of the world. When you hear that the statistics are incredibly and, you know, shockingly high in Scotland, that's just so sad, and something should really happen.
What is the purpose of it exactly? What does it actually do? How does it create a connection between them and Allah by mutilating the genital? That's ridiculous.
Well, it is all about getting women under control, isn't it?
But we fight with one hand behind our backs, because the Scottish Secular Society could and should be at the forefront as spokespeople speaking very loudly on this in Scotland. But we're not given the same airtime as, say, the Church of Scotland, or see, even a lot of the extremists in the church, which the media love. Take, for example, the press release. But actually, every press release that goes out from the Church of Scotland ends up in Scotland's broadsheets. Yet, when we won 30,000 signatures to release Mohammed Asghar from a jail in Pakistan, a Scotsman in a jail in Pakistan, a very sick and ill man in a jail in Pakistan, facing charges of blasphemy, and he's still there after many months, the press weren't interested, didn't want to cover it. And these are really important, vital issues that really should be out there, and we should be talking about them.
I just don't understand how people could just behave like that. It just boggles the mind.
Yeah. Thanks. I mean, general mutilation, I mean, one of the large monotheism do stay, and you know, some of the more liberal or moderate Muslims will say that it is nothing to do with their religion, and it's a real regional cultural issue. Then, you know, how do you define a cultural issue, and why is it so entrenched with religion if it's a cultural issue?
And slavery was a cultural issue when they got
absolutely.
Rid of that. Impact that. So if that's a cultural issue, when could she see the result it has? Get fucking rid of it, isn't it?
And we want rid of it. There can be no quarter. The door can't be left slightly ajar to it. And I think it comes down to a lot of it is the relationship between the non-religious and the religious, between politicians, between the authorities, between health boards, people who interface at that level, and the type of language that they use. And nothing constructive takes place. I mean, can you believe it's taken us this long for a letter to go out? I mean, a letter. Just to say, keep your eye out, folks. This goes on. Keep your eye out, folks. These young girls are being sliced wide open with a blunt razor in a foreign country, then being brought back to UK, or in some back street of an inner city in Scotland that's being performed by someone flown into the UK to do it. Or it astonishes me the inertia we have towards this, towards our religious representatives, of speaking kindly to them and giving them a nudge and saying, look, you couldn't pay attention to this for us, could you? You know, we think it's a little bit wrong because we're all terrified because the language we may use may be deemed inappropriate. We may be labelled. We may be called too aggressive, too confrontational. Slicing people open.
Considering what they're doing, I think it's appropriate. It's the right time to say, fuck you, don't do that to my child, or do this to a child, it's retarded.
Unfortunately, so, we won't, will we? We won't do that. That's the sad reality. So voices like Scottish Secular Society, we have to be the ones that don't just condemn those practices, we condemn our own government for failing to act. Yeah, we condemn our own government, our elected officials, for sitting on their hands and allowing this to happen and telling us they don't have the resource, want or need to pursue this complicated and cultural matter as how it's always positioned.
Right, not fighting against it is almost, complacency is almost like permission.
Absolutely, Sheila. It's incredibly frustrating for our group to constantly read these things, and when the statements come out, and how they're going to tackle it, what the strategy is and what the guidelines are. It gets lost in the system. It's just another thing. For me, it's black and white. For me, it is an absolute. It is something that if this happens, your child should be taken off the people that have performed a violent act on the child or have allowed and facilitated such a violent act. You know, if you did something like that, so if I did that to my own son, if I decided to go into his room right now while he's sleeping and circumcise him in the context of not being religious and just because I think it's better for his health that I slice the top of his foreskin off, I would be prosecuted. I would be in the cell tonight and I would be up in court on Monday morning facing prosecution. But if I say that, well, it's actually part of my belief system, it's okay. Fine.
It's stupid.
It is.
I find it baffles me. It baffles me. It really does. And we'll continue to put our eyes. Certainly, we don't have the power to act. We certainly have a voice that we can use and a platform in which we can now use it. And we intend to do so.
Yes.
I think that's a fairly universal problem, too. In any civilized country, they're all, for the most part, they're afraid to stand up or protest anything for either religious or political connection. You know, it makes it harder to get anything accomplished when you're having to fight against the entire system. But that, and people are just too apathetic to even, you know, to even be concerned about it. And it's hard to get the word out when you have a media that's trying to mute anything that's of any sort of importance.
Well, there is one point I want to bring up, and it's the one I feel like, you know, with regards to things like the opt-in and all that kind of stuff in school. Is I've spoken about this, like I've got friends at work and they're now parents and all that. You know, when they find out what my position is, the usual attitude is, oh, just leave it alone. It doesn't do any harm. Mm-hmm. It's just a nice little thing, you know, doing a prayer every week. And I find that's kind of the biggest problem we face in Scotland with regards to it's kind of an apathy and just an acceptance that it's just that way. Just leave it alone.
Carl, you make a good point. And I often get asked by many of my friends and I get challenged on it. Dinner parties, nights out, etc. What's this whole secular thing about spirits? You know, why are you involved? What's your problem with religion being in schools? And, you know, it didn't do us any harm. So, you know, I throw back at them a rather crude paradigm shift. And I ask them, you know, well, are you religious? Do you go to church? Now, the majority of my friends claim to be atheists. They also claim that the church didn't have any effect on them and that the church on a day-to-day basis in the UK doesn't really impinge or, you know, they're fairly oblivious to the activities or actions or influence of the church. So therefore they think, well, it's not a problem, so I'm just going to leave it. Now, if you look at the statistics and the decline of the church in Scotland at the moment, and if you draw that up against the growth of Islam in Scotland, in about 15 to 20 years' time, possibly earlier, Islam will be the majority religion in Scotland. So, you know, I try and establish, first of all, that they're happy with the status quo and that's what they agreed to, they're religious, and they don't mind if their child has participation in religious observance, religious assembly, religious and moral education. And then I draw them along to this decline of religion and the year-on-year rise in the Muslim faith in Scotland. And then I say, well, you know, would you still have a problem then when your grandchildren or, you know, you say you have children later on, depending on your age, if you're 15, 13, 20 years' time, will you be happy then if the local imam takes over the role of conducting religious observance? And suddenly there's a look of horror on people's faces. Suddenly that is an issue. Suddenly that is a problem to them. And it isn't something that they're particularly happy with. And that's when I say to them, well, how you feel right now is how I feel. That's how I feel about the current situation with religious observance in school. It's not a case of which religion, it's a case of the very fact it's religion. It's the very fact that people I haven't requested or asked for to go into our education system and teach my children about something I personally want to teach them about. For them to tell my children and assume that they somehow own the right to teach morals and ethics to my children and somehow I'm incapable of doing that. And when I have that discussion with my friends, you know, the paradigm shift really kicks in. They're like, well, you know, I haven't really thought about that and I can't actually envisage a day that the imams can go into primary schools or high schools. And I say, well, I can envisage that, especially in Glasgow, where, you know, there's a large demographic of the Muslim faith in Glasgow, of Islam. And that is potentially something they can quite happily request. In the long term, we don't deal with religious observance now and remove it, or remove its principles in its current form in our school, our education system, then there is a consequence that you will not agree to. You know, it doesn't matter to me which religion it is. I just think they should all be removed. Religious observance should have a place only for people who want religious observance. Not, the assumption shouldn't be made for people like myself, atheists like myself, that my child is going to have it whether I like it or not. I think it's more of a case of, no, if your children want it and that group of children want it, you know, that particular group, with that particular belief system, would feel more comfortable with like-minded children, that makes a lot more sense. You know, and then I start to see the more and more of the people within my circle sort of start switching on to why we think religious observance in its current format doesn't fit and it's wrong. And it was a real shame that the government missed an opportunity with religious observance. But I think we'll revisit it. And I think if we start to look into the two areas that we claimed we would look into, and that is where does the access to information, what does access to information look like and what does it look like? And also, what does the alternative meaningful provision for religious observance look like? I think once they start looking at that and perhaps auditing it, or they pass it on to their school inspectors to audit, I think their findings are fairly horrendous and that we've been right all along. So, yeah, it's a real biggie for us, and it still is. It's our flagship cause, as you know, but it's something that we are certainly not going to allow Mary Scanlon to just knock off the edge of the table because it's too corona.
What happens next with the opt-in petition now that it's been somewhat pushed aside in the government? Do you have a next step with it?
Yeah, we do. We certainly do. We have to wait to see what the correspondence from the Education and Culture Committee actually looks like, and then we can write our response to that. But as I highlighted, there are two areas that they agreed, in principle anyway, that they would have a look at. And it's actually the two areas that makes a lot of sense for them to look at that we would ask them to. And that is, where is the information and how accessible is the information for children or parents who want to opt out of religious observance? Because, you know, the statistics are horrendous. You know, 40% of parents are actually completely unaware that they can even opt out of religious observance. And they have a difficulty in actually finding it or the school even informing them about it. But the other area where I think if it's classed as school inspectors to actually audit and measure and feedback to the government on how effective their current policy is, and that's around what does the alternative meaningful provision look like for children who do opt out. And what they'll find, I believe, is a collective within school of disenfranchised children, of children that don't have meaningful alternative education, that have been left in a room to sit and play with their phones, but not their phones, maybe some gamepad, or to read a book to colour in, because that's the choice that was offered to my child. I was told a month ago, when I asked, what will my four-year-old be doing if I opt him out of religious observance? Oh, we have two Jehovah kids. He'll sit in a room with them. And I'm like, so what do you mean sit in a room with them? Well, we don't have a resource. We don't have a teacher that can look after them. So what we usually do is we we give an extra hour to one of the nursery assistants to sit in the room and just supervise and monitor them to make sure they're safe. Right. And,
well,
that's it? Yeah, that's it. So that's what he'll get for the next 6 years of his schooling? Yeah. And how long will he sit in there? For half an hour. So I said, so for half an hour, every week for the next 6 years, you're going to give my son some meaningless form of education because your school refused to provide an adequate system or adequate provision where he will learn something meaningful. He will, pretty much, yeah, that's it. So that's what I'm left faced with. You know, as many other parents are, I guarantee every other parent who goes to any primary school in Scotland will face the exact same thing.
I just wanted to clarify that in Scotland you have religious and moral education, which is learning about different religions, which is very important and which the Scottish Secular Society support. And you also have religious observance, which essentially is forced praying. And that, a lot of secularists don't support it. I think we take a more realistic thing, a lot of freedom of, you know, choice. Parents do want their children to have religious observance. So our idea is fine, but let's inform parents about what's going on. We gave the Parliament lots of evidence that parents weren't being informed of what was happening to their children. Had one case where the Church of Christ, with its homophobic and anti-science agenda, had infiltrated a primary school in the outside East Kilbride for 8 years without parents knowing. That means the ministers were taking their children out on trips, all with the connivance of support of people who were in authority within the school. And we still have not had proper answers. In fact, the local authority have refused to give answers as to whether these ministers had been vetted or checked as people who are in charge of children should be. So opt-in, all it is basically let's inform parents about what religious observance is, what goes on, who does it, how long, how often, these trips to churches, where are they going? These clerics who are invited into the school, who are they? Simply informing parents. That's all it is. And we are being brick-walled.
Yeah. It's a massive problem, and it is a mess. The system is a complete mess. There is no real rules. There is no appropriate guidelines. The guidelines exist on policy and paper only. That's all. They're not implemented. They're not followed through. My ex-partner phoned me 2 weeks ago. Her son and her daughter go to Kinghorn Primary in Fife. And she said that one of the teachers was leaving. It has real close links to this local church. And the minister is in the school. He comes into school, I believe, right after science classes in Primary 6 and Primary 7 and talks about creationism. Now, she's not willing to go public with this, and she's not willing to come to the Secular Society for us to take it on, because she fears for her younger child, who is still at the school. The older child is leaving to go to high school after the summer. But she fears for because she's already seen the teacher starting to lean on the younger one. Like when they're in prayers, they have to go to the, once a month they have to go to the church to attend prayers, to sing hymns, and for whatever, they always invent a reason to take the children down for an hour on a Friday afternoon once a month. So they sing Hosanna, they hear the sermon, they hear all that. And the teacher invigilates the children when they're doing the Lord's Prayer. So she will walk around the kids, and the ones who aren't bowing their head down and reciting the Lord's Prayer will be reprimanded after the class. They'll be pulled to the side and they'll be asked, why were you not saying the Lord's Prayer? Why was that? And this is going on now. This is live. This is happening right now. And this child, I can't obviously say her name, said, because I don't believe in a God. The teacher then phones my ex-partner and says, well, why are you telling your daughter that there's no God? Why are you doing this? And she says, well, we're an atheist family and I don't want my son or my daughter going to the church anymore. What provision do you make? What alternative provision? We don't make any alternative provision. This is the headmaster falling down the phone saying, we don't make any. And who do you think you are asking us to give your children special dispensation? By removing them from the school class, by removing them from our authority. Well, I'm really sorry, but the only thing that you can do is keep your kids off school if you don't like them going to church. And that is just one instance, one school, and that happens across every single school in Scotland. There may be one or two on the ball that deal with it more appropriately, but they're the kind of day-to-day problems. And unfortunately, because children, parents and families feel marginalised when this happens, they refuse to go public with it. They won't challenge it, they won't report it, because they don't know who to go to. And they're terrified if they go to the school teacher, the teacher-parent relationship will become distorted as negative. And then the teacher is then terrified to go to whatever religious body is conducting religious observance. So we have a domino effect of the power sits at the top and nobody wants to challenge it.
Parents have inundated the Scottish Sector Society with examples of what is actually going on in Scottish schools.
Yeah, colouring in of torture apparatus. No, that's been posted up on the internet. Kids being pictures of crucifix, being given pictures of David in the lion's den and other slaves being fed to lions and being asked to colour this in. It's just incredible. Scenes of violence, 5-year-olds are asked to give. And then teachers are marking them. Are giving them marks out of 10 to see how good it is.
Yeah.
Getting blisters because they're sharpening pencils, getting nightmares because they're being told stories of Jesus being nailed to the cross.
And shown videos as well. That's something else I hear that's happening in Ayrshire now. They're being shown videos of all the different stories within the Bible, and some of them are of a fairly violent nature. So children are coming home and asking their parents, Mum, about this God and Jesus thing, and why have you never told me about this before? People coming back to life, people being nailed to a cross. Why does that happen? Will that happen to me?
Well, Spencer, again, Bob heard about stories of people's experiences, students' experiences. It again reminds me of what me myself experienced in school years in Iran. We had compulsory religious classes every year, and if you were not going through them, you actually had to leave the school. But yes, there is the possibility of opt out, but if the kid is under 16 years old, that's not up to the kid's decision. So the parents should make that decision for the kid. And if they do not do that for any reason, religious reasons or social reasons or whatsoever, the kid has to go through those matters, although may not like to or not believe to. So I think opt-in is crucial and it should happen. And secular society is going to go fight for that.
I think, Robin, you make a good point. It's absolutely paramount that we get to a stage where we can revisit that. But I think what we have to do and continue to do, and hopefully the government will find this themselves if they do inspect schools and audit them on how they're facilitating the requirement, they'll find it for themselves. If they ask the question, if they go back to the schools and investigate this and speak to parents, speak to children, monitor the local minister and actually see what is being observed. If children are being forced into today, if they're proselytizing to the children, if it's confessional, then all this needs to be audited. And the opportunity we'll get as a secular society is when we get a correspondence back from the Education and Culture Committee to see how they are going to implement and how they are going to take forward their actions. We can make the request or recommendation that is what they should be looking at, and that's what they need to get feedback from school.
Yeah, have you got in touch with any of the auditors of the school perhaps that your child is in, and have they been able to influence any decisions?
I've written to the head of Vice Council who looks after, for my schools anyway, for my, who is responsible for all the education services in Fife, happens in the next school year. I have even actually asked my local primary school my son goes to, if they will voluntarily put in, because if the lecture goes out, a plaque goes out to every parent at the start of primary one that tells them all about the school dress code, behaviour codes, good citizenship programmes, and everything that the school basically is looking for from a national level and a local level. And I've asked, can you please make parents aware that they have the opportunity to opt out of religious education? And she point blank said no. She said no. And I said, well, why not? Is that not a fair way to do it? She goes, it'll just cause all sorts of hassle. And I said, but you're only doing what the government is asking you to do, and that is make them aware. She goes, it's in our school handbook. If they want to see it, they can see it there. So this was the assistant head. The head has refused to actually engage with me. And that's the kind of, now, and she knows I'm a member of the Scottish Secular Society. She knows that, you know, I have a route of access to making this public. And she still refused to engage with me. Now, I've not had a correspondence back from Fife Council yet. But if I don't get one, I'm going to keep calling and ask for an appointment to see if they will actually take the lead on this. I think we've got more potential seeking a good council who are more likely to implement policy that don't have as much religious interference as, say, the Highlands and Islands or Lanarkshire. And if we can get one council to take the lead on informing patients about the right to opt out and how that is framed and how that is positioned and the wording that they actually use and what the alternative looks like, because this is a real problem for the school as well, is they don't have the resource. They don't have the resource to facilitate a large group of a large group of students who want to opt out. So say 10 or 15 out of the class want to opt out, then suddenly they really will. They can't allow 15 children to sit idle for 25 minutes a week for the next 6 years. They'll be forced to give them something meaningful and proactive and educational.
Also, if you go on our website, the ScottishSecularSociety.com, you'll be able to access a story about a former chair, Caroline Lynch, who actually went with a parent to a Catholic school. And you can read about her experiences. You can also read about my experiences with Pam Stencil, who was brought over, I think she was doing a talk, a very damaged person, I think, who was doing a talk in the Northern Ireland Assembly. She was flown over to a Paisley school where they were coaching in children under the guise of religious and moral education, where she screamed at them from the stage about how condoms weren't safe, spewing out a list of diseases, some of which are curable, but she was screaming out that they can kill you. One girl was actually had to have counselling. She was put in shock. And this is happening today in Scottish schools.
What's topical at the moment is, and I intend to go to Falkirk on Tuesday night with my secular hat on, is there's an issue with one of the schools there where at the moment, if you are in the catchment of a Roman Catholic school, you are perfectly legally entitled to attend that school. Now, if you're applying to go to that school by letter and you're not within the catchment area, then the school actually has a right to discriminate against you in preference of a child who has been baptised. They have a right to discriminate against a child that is not a Roman Catholic, that's non-denominational. So
that's ridiculous.
So what the Falkirk Council are proposing is they're moving the goalposts. Now, this actually, and if I'm correct, contravenes the Equality Act, and it also contravenes the Education Scotland Act. Because what they plan to do is even children who fall within the catchment area of that specific Roman Catholic school, they're going to tell them that positions within the school will only be given, the preference will be given to children who can prove they have been baptised. Directly discriminating against non-religious children. Because the school has they've got too many applicants, so obviously all those who want to subscribe can't. So what they intend to do is intentionally discriminate against non-religious families and only afford places to children who can prove they have been baptised and are indeed Roman Catholic.
How do you think they've been baptised then? With a certificate or?
That's a good question. Because I don't know how they would prove they've been baptised. If they're from another country, if they're from a different authority, I have no idea how they would prove that.
I can only think of a certificate would be, you know, the only thing that would be substantial, but nothing more than that.
Or a letter, indeed, from...
Yeah, a letter.
But it's the very fact that they intend to discriminate against non-religious children, I find that utterly abhorrent. I find it despicable that we're tolerating that, when it completely contravenes the rules and guidelines and the rights of the child. It contravened all sorts of acts, the Human Rights of the Child, the Equalities Act for Scotland, the Education Act in Scotland, yet Falkirk Council seems to think that, you know, and by the way, this is a proposal, this isn't cemented in stone, so that's why I want to go along and listen to the dialogue and the debate that I expect, and the anger that I expect to take place, and it would be great if I could actually inform some of the non-religious parents that are there that are probably pulling their hair out because they... And the next nearest school is probably 15 miles away. And that actually what the school is doing is illegal. Or potentially illegal.
I was going to ask you, Empty, what's the situation with religious observance down in your area, in schools?
My area, well, in the part of Wales I'm in, they're actually quite religious, quite Christian, evangelical there. And there's a Catholic, Anglo-Saxon school up by my university there is. And they're nice people, but I can imagine them being, you know, what we're just hearing now, they'd be quite anti-anybody else who's not a Christian. I can imagine that taking place for sure, being quite discriminatory against the other religions. But in a sense, really, the vast majority of people here are nice, but I can imagine that taking place. I'm not too familiar with it, but I've heard this and that, but nothing more than that, really.
Yeah, probably just a quick question to Spencer and Ramin. Do you have much networking with foreign secular groups?
Myself?
No, just Spencer and Ramin.
Sorry, I was again, isn't
it? Yeah, right. No, not at the moment. However, I'm glad you asked that, Carl. It's something we had our very first strategy meeting 3 weeks ago, and something that we need to do as a group at the moment. I mean, when I inherited this position from Caroline, I felt that the organisation was very much coming out of its adolescence, that, you know, structurally, organically, philosophically, strategically, we were really moving towards a mainline position within Scotland, that we were becoming very clear on what our focus was and what we need to be as an organisation. And part of that sort of growing up is who we affiliate ourselves with and who affiliates themselves to us. And that's something that, you know, over the next 11 months, I'm really keen to develop. Mark Gordon has actually prepared and shared a whole list of secular organisations that we need to reach out to, that we need to network with as well, because something that's important to us is to raise the profile of the organisation. Now, because we all do this voluntarily, obviously, we're not paid, we don't have a marketing department, we don't have a professional spin. And we have Gary Upton, he's not bad at all that. But yeah, we need to reach out, and our outreach strategy is very much linking ourselves in with other secular groups. I mean, the shout for independence was enormous for our cause. I mean, it really was. Our awareness of secular Scotland went all the way up to a national level. I mean, I'd be very surprised if Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmon actually weren't made aware in some capacity that we'd come out in support of independence. So, yeah, it's on our to-do list, and we're doing it as we speak.
Well, for sure, we should work with other secular groups and societies, because at the end of the day, we all aim the same thing. We may take different strategies, but, for example, when we are campaigning on the education petition, we should expect other secular societies to back us, to support us, because at the end of the day, it is what that gonna benefit the whole society. So, me and Gary had a chat with the education officer of the Humanist Society of Scotland a couple of days ago. It was a good chat, but so yes, we try to make links as far as the others will to do so as well.
And to other religions as well, because that's very important too. Of course, for humanists, they're kind of secular anyway, but we need to reach out to a moderate church, a church who are secular, and to stem this growth of extremist churches, which I hope I'll talk about next week.
Yes, because that is bringing us to the end. We're just in the last few minutes of the show. So
yes.
A very big thank you to Spencer and Ramin for turning up. It's been fantastic.
Thank you.
Cheers.
I always leave the guests just to have a little bit. I mean, you've both been talking quite a lot. So just to let everyone know, if they want more information, if they want to get involved, where they can find us.
Yeah, we're on, we have our website, the Scottish Secular Society website. We have a Facebook page, Scottish Secular Society. However, the hub of all our activity, which I implore anyone and everyone to go on, is the Secular Scotland page, or a group on Facebook. Just type in Secular Scotland and you'll find us all there. So please join.
Okay, that's great. And I'll just quickly go round the panel for their final thoughts. Marty.
Yeah, very interesting to hear about what's going on in Scotland. I had no idea it was like, well, the way you say it is.
Yeah.
I just figured it was pretty secular.
Almost sort of similar.
I'd heard about this whole religious observance thing, but you make it come off as if it's far worse than I had heard.
Yeah. So, what, did yeah, you think it's interesting. Think it was like a similar situation to Sweden almost that we had?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, right. Sheila.
Oh, I just wanted to say thanks for coming on. It was great to get a chance to finally meet both of you. Love the conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Empty, you came along late, but also it's good to welcome you back to the show as well.
Yeah. I'd like to say thank you very much for coming on the show, guys. I'm sorry for coming in late, and I probably missed a lot of it, but I just thoroughly enjoyed talking to you, and it was really insightful. Like Martin has said, that I was just made aware by you two guys, and it's good to see that you're really proactive. And I guess that's what the key element that we're missing as a secular society is being proactive to say no, don't do that to children, don't
do this.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yes, good to see that. You're happy to say fuck you, don't do that.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thumbs up.
All right. Yeah, everyone in the chat room, if you can get your thumbs up, that'd be great. Just to let everyone know, we'll be back next week. We have some guy called Gary Orton with us. Gary, do you know this guy?
Sounds very similar. This is what I'm blogging. It's my new book.
See, you're even getting a little preview at the end of this.
Look at that. Look at that. Isn't that cool? 519 pages of it. It's my new book out. It's my second one. And it's called Religious Fascism. It's about the repeal of Section 28.
Yes, that'll be an interesting one to listen to. So, everyone, just to let you know, the show's going to be uploaded to YouTube within the next 24 hours, and then it's uploaded to iTunes sometime later on in the week. I realise we've fallen behind with getting the podcast updated. We've caught up with everything. It's been due to my schedule and to Richard, again, the editor, Richard. He's fantastic. Look up the name Prototype Audio Editor on Elance, and you'll find him. If you're doing a podcast, he does awesome work. So thank you very much, everyone. If you have any further questions, contact @trollingwithlogic.com or go to the Scottish Secular Society webpage where you can contact Spencer or Ramin, and I'm sure they'll be happy to answer any questions that may have arisen. So with that, right. I don't think there's any further announcements from anyone, is there? Sheila, we usually just check. Is A News coming out soon?
Yeah, we tape every Sunday night, and it usually gets released on Tuesdays. So yeah,
check that one out.
Definitely check that out.
Okay, so thank you very much for turning up, everyone. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And like I say, if your weekend's just starting, have a good one. Or if your Saturday night's just about to start, please enjoy it. And we shall see everyone next week. Thank you all, and have a very good night.
See you next week.
Thank you.
Take care.
See you next week. Bye.